The president read it too, but had a different reaction. He made some notes and saved them until 7:30 when Susan Penn, his interim director of the CIA, arrived for the morning briefing. The PDB, President's Daily Briefing, had historically been handled by the director himself, always in the Oval Office and normally the first item of the day's business. But Teddy Maynard and his rotten health had changed the routine, and for the past 10 years, the briefings had been done by someone else. Now traditions were being honored again. An 8-to-10-page summary of intelligence matters was placed on the president's desk precisely at 7 a.m. After almost 2 months in office, he had developed the habit of reading every word of it. He found it fascinating. His predecessor had once boasted that he read hardly anything – books, newspapers, magazines, certainly not legislation, policies, treaties, or daily briefings. He had often had trouble reading his own speeches. Things were much different now. Susan Penn was driven in an armored car from her Georgetown home to the White House, where she arrived each morning at 7:15. Along the way, she read the daily summary, which was prepared by the CIA. On page 4 that morning was an item about Joel Backman. He was attracting the attention of some very dangerous people, perhaps even Sammy Tin. The president greeted her warmly and had coffee waiting by the sofa. They were alone, as always, and they went right to work.
"You've seen the New York Times this morning," he asked.
"Yes."
"What are the chances that Backman paid for a pardon?"
"Very slim. As I've explained before, he had no idea one was in the works. He didn't have time to arrange things. Plus, we're quite confident he didn't have the money."
"Then why was Backman pardoned?"
Susan Penn's loyalty to Teddy Maynard was fast becoming history. Teddy was gone and would soon be dead, but she, at the age of 44, had a career left. Perhaps a long one. She and the president were working well together. He seemed in no hurry to appoint his new director. Frankly, Teddy wanted him dead.
"Why? What is your recollection of why Mr. Maynard wanted him dead?"
"It's a long story."
"No, it's not.
We don't know everything."
"You know enough. Tell me what you know."
She tossed her copy of the summary on the sofa and took a deep breath.
"Backman and J.C. Hubbard got in way over their heads. They had this software, JAM, that their clients had stupidly brought to the United States, to their office, looking for a fortune."
"These clients were the young Pakistanis, right?"
"Yes, and they're all dead."
"Do you know who killed them?"
"No."
"Do you know who killed J.C. Hubbard?"
"No."
The president stood with his coffee and walked to his desk. He sat on the edge and glared across the room at her.
"I find it hard to believe that we don't know these things."
"Frankly, so do I. And it's not because we haven't tried. It's one reason Teddy worked so hard to get Backman pardoned. Sure, he wanted him dead just on general principle. The two have a history, and Teddy has always considered Backman to be a traitor. But he also felt strongly that Backman's murder might tell us something."
"What?"
"Depends on who kills him. If the Russians do it, then we can believe the satellite system belonged to the Russians. Same for the Chinese. If the Israelis kill him, then there's a good chance Backman and Hubbard tried to sell their product to the Saudis. If the Saudis get to him, then we can believe that Backman double-crossed them. We're almost certain that the Saudis thought they had a deal."
"But Backman screwed them?"
"Maybe not. We think Hubbard's death changed everything. Backman packed his bags and ran away to prison. All deals were off."
The president walked back to the coffee table and refilled his cup. He sat across from her and shook his head.
"You expect me to believe that three young Pakistani hackers tapped into a satellite system so sophisticated that we didn't even know about it?"
"Yes, they were brilliant, but they also got lucky. Then they not only hacked their way in, but they wrote some amazing programs that manipulated it."
"And that's JAM?"
"That's what they called it."
"Has anybody ever seen the software?"
"The Saudis. That's how we know that it not only exists, but probably works as well as advertised."
Where is the software now?
No one knows, except maybe Backman himself. A long pause as the president sipped his lukewarm coffee. Then he rested his elbows on his knees and said, "What's best for us, Susan? What's in our best interests?" She didn't hesitate. "To follow Teddy's plan. Backman will be eliminated. The software hasn't been seen in 6 years, so it's probably gone too. The satellite system is up there, but whoever owns it can't play with it."
Another sip, another pause. The president shook his head and said, "So be it."
Neil Backman didn't read the New York Times, but he did a quick search each morning for his father's name. When he ran across Frick's story, he attached it to an email and sent it with the morning message from Jerry's Java. At his desk, he read the story again and relived the old rumors of how much money the broker had buried while the firm was collapsing. He'd never asked his father the question point blank because he knew he would not get a straight answer. Over the years, though, he had come to accept the common belief that Joel Backman was as broke as most convicted felons. Then why did he have the nagging feeling that the cash for pardon scheme could be true? Because if anyone buried so deep in a federal prison could pull off such a miracle, it was his father. But how did he get to Bologna, Italy? And why? Who was after him? The questions were piling up, the answers more elusive than ever. As he sipped his double mocha and stared at his locked office door, he once again asked himself the great question. How does one go about locating a certain Swiss banker without the use of phones, faxes, regular mail, or email? He'd figure it out. He just needed time. The Times story was read by Ephraim as he rode the train from Florence to Bologna. A call from Tel Aviv had alerted him, and he found it online. Amos was four seats behind him, also reading it on his laptop. Rafi and Shaul would arrive early the next morning. Rafi on a flight from Milan, Shaul on a train from Rome. The four Italian-speaking members of the Kidon were already in Bologna, hurriedly putting together the two safe houses they would need for the project. The preliminary plan was to grab Backman under the darkened porticos along Via Fondazza or another suitable side street, preferably early in the morning or after dark. They would sedate him, shove him in a van, take him to a safe house, and wait for the drugs to wear off. They would interrogate him, eventually kill him with poison, and drive his body 2 hours north to Lake Garda, where he'd be fed to the fish. The plan was rough and fraught with pitfalls, but the green light had been given. There was no turning back. Now that Backman was getting so much attention, they had to strike quickly. The race was also fueled by the fact that the Mossad had good reason to believe that Sammy Tin was either in Bologna or somewhere close. The nearest restaurant to her apartment was a lovely old trattoria called Nino's. She knew the place well and had known the two sons of old Nino for many years. She explained her predicament, and when she arrived, both of them were waiting and practically carried her inside. They took her cane, her bag, her coat, and walked her slowly to their favorite table, which they'd moved closer to the fireplace. They brought her coffee and water and offered anything else she could possibly want. It was mid-afternoon. The lunch crowd was gone. Francesca and her student had Nino's to themselves. When Marco arrived a few minutes later, the two brothers greeted him like family. "La professoressa la sta aspettando," one of them said. "The teacher is waiting." The fall on the gravel at San Luca and the sprained ankle had transformed her. Gone was the frosty indifference. Gone was the sadness, at least for now. She smiled when she saw him, even reached up, grabbed his hand, and pulled him close so they could blow air kisses at both cheeks, a custom Marco had been observing for 2 months but had yet to engage in. This was, after all, his first female acquaintance in Italy. She waved him to the chair directly across from her. The brothers swarmed around, taking his coat, asking him about coffee, anxious to see what an Italian lesson would look and sound like.
"How's your foot?" Marco asked, and made the mistake of doing so in English. She put her finger to her lips, shook her head, and said,
"Non inglese, Marco. Solamente italiano."
He frowned and said, "I was afraid of that." Her foot was very sore. She kept it on ice while she was reading or watching television, and the swelling had gone down. The walk to the restaurant had been slow, but it was important to move about. At her mother's insistence, she was using a cane. She found it both useful and embarrassing. More coffee and water arrived, and when the brothers were convinced that things were perfect with their dear friend Francesca and her Canadian student, they reluctantly retreated to the front of the restaurant.
"How is your mother?" he asked in Italian.
"Very well, very tired. She has been sitting with Giovanni for a month now, and it's taking a toll."
So, thought Marco, Giovanni is now available for discussion.
"How is he?"
"Inoperable brain cancer," she said, and it took a few tries to get the translation right. "He has been suffering for almost a year, and the end is quite close. He is unconscious. It's a pity."
"What was his profession? What did he do?"
"He taught medieval history at the university for many years. They met there. She was a student. He was her professor. At the time, he was married to a woman he disliked immensely. They had two sons. She and her professor fell in love and began an affair which lasted almost 10 years before he divorced his wife and married Francesca."
"Children?"
"No," she said with sadness. "Giovanni had two. He didn't want any more."
She had regrets, many regrets.
The feeling was clear that the marriage had not been a happy one. "Wait till we get around to mine," thought Marco. It didn't take long.
"Tell me about you," she said. "Speak slowly. I want the accents to be as good as possible."
"I'm just a Canadian businessman," Marco began in Italian.
"No, really. What's your real name?"
"No.
What is it?"
"For now, it's Marco. I have a long history, Francesca, and I can't talk about it."
"Very well. Do you have children?"
"Ah, yes." For a long time, he talked about his three children, their names, ages, occupations, residences, spouses, children. He added some fiction to move along his narrative, and he pulled off a small miracle by making the family sound remotely normal. Francesca listened intently, waiting to pounce on any wayward pronunciation or improperly conjugated verb. One of Nino's boys brought some chocolates and lingered long enough to say with a huge smile,
"Parla molto bene, signore."
"You speak very well, sir." She began to fidget after an hour, and Marco could tell she was uncomfortable. He finally convinced her to leave, and with great pleasure, he walked her back down Via Menzoni, her right hand tightly fixed to his left elbow, while her left hand worked the cane. They walked as slowly as possible. She dreaded the return to her apartment, to the death watch, the vigil. He wanted to walk for miles, to cling to her touch, to feel the hand of someone who needed him. At her apartment, they traded farewell kisses and made arrangements to meet at Nino's tomorrow. Same time, same table. J.C. Hubbard spent almost 25 years in Washington, a quarter of a century of major league hell-raising with an astounding string of disposable women. The last had been May Sun, a beauty almost 6 feet tall with perfect features, deadly black eyes, and a husky voice that had no trouble at all getting J.C. out of a bar and into a car. After an hour of rough sex, she had delivered him to Sammy Tin, who finished him off, and left him at his brother's grave. When sex was needed to set up a kill, Sammy preferred May Sun. She was a fine MSS agent in her own right, but the legs and face added a dimension that had proved deadly on at least 3 occasions. He summoned her to Bologna, not to seduce, but to hold hands with another agent and pretend to be happily married tourists. Seduction, though, was always a possibility.
especially with Backman. Poor guy had just spent 6 years locked up, away from women.
May spotted Marco as he moved in a crowd down Strada Maggiore, headed in the general direction of Via Fondazza. With amazing agility, she picked up her pace, pulled out a cell phone, and managed to gain ground on him while still looking like a bored window shopper. Then he was gone. He suddenly took a left, turned down a narrow alley, Via Bagatto, and headed north away from Via Fondazza. By the time she made the turn, he was out of sight. Chapter 25. Spring was finally arriving in Bologna. The last flurries of snow had fallen. The temperature had approached 50 degrees the day before, and when Marco stepped outside before dawn, he thought about swapping his parka for one of the other jackets. He took a few steps under the dark portico, let the temperature sink in, then decided it was still chilly enough to keep the parka. He'd return in a couple of hours, and he could switch then if he wanted. He crammed his hands in his pockets and took off on the morning hike. He could think of nothing but the Times story. To see his name plastered across the front page brought back painful memories, and that was unsettling enough. But to be accused of bribing the president was actionable at law. And in another life, he would have started the day by shotgunning lawsuits at everyone involved. He would have owned the New York Times. But what kept him awake were the questions. What would the attention mean for him now? Would Luigi snatch him again and run away? And the most important, was he in more danger today than yesterday? He was surviving nicely, tucked away in a lovely city where no one knew his real name. No one recognized his face. No one cared. The Bolognese went about their lives without disturbing others. Not even he recognized himself. Each morning when he finished shaving and put on his glasses and his brown corduroy driver's cap, he stood at the mirror and said hello to Marco. Long gone were the fleshy jowls and puffy dark eyes, the thicker, longer hair. Long gone was the smirk and the arrogance. Now he was just another quiet man on the street. Marco was living one day at a time, and the days were piling up. No one who read the Times story knew where Marco was or what he was doing. He passed a man in a dark suit and instantly knew he was in trouble. The suit was out of place. It was a foreign variety, something bought off the rack in a low-end store, one he had seen every day in another life. The white shirt was the same monotonous button-down he had seen for 30 years in D.C. He'd once considered floating an office memo banning blue and white cotton button-downs, but Carl Pratt had talked him out of it. He couldn't tell the color of the tie. It was not the type of suit you'd ever see under the porticos along Via Fondazza before dawn, or at any other time for that matter. He took a few steps, glanced over his shoulder, and saw that the suit was now following him. White guy, 30 years old, thick, athletic, the clear winner in a foot race or a fist fight. So Marco used another strategy. He suddenly stopped, turned around, and said, "You want something?" To which someone else said, "Over here, Backman." Hearing his name stopped him cold. For a second, his knees were rubbery. His shoulders sagged, and he told himself that no, he was not dreaming. In a flash, he thought of all the horrors the word Backman brought with it. How sad to be so terrified of your own name. There were two of them. The one with the voice arrived on the scene from the other side of Via Fondazza. He had basically the same suit, but with a bold white shirt with no buttons on the collar. He was older, shorter, and much thinner. Mutt and Jeff, thick and thin. "What do you want?" Marco said. They were slowly reaching for their pockets. "We're with the FBI," the thick one said. "American English, probably Midwest." "Sure you are," Marco said. They went through the required ritual of flashing their badges, but under the darkness of the portico, Marco could read nothing. The dim light over an apartment door helped a little. "I can't read those," he said. "Let's take a walk," said the thin one. Boston Irish, Walk came out walk.
You guys lost, Marco said without moving. He didn't want to move, and his feet were quite heavy anyway.
We know exactly where we are.
I doubt that. You got a warrant?
We don't need one.
The thick one made the mistake of touching Marco's left elbow, as if he would help him move along to where they wanted to go. Marco jerked away.
Don't touch me. You boys get lost. You can't make an arrest here. All you can do is talk.
Fine. Let's go have a chat, said the thin one.
I don't have to talk.
There's a coffee shop a couple of blocks away, said the thick one.
Great. Have some coffee and a pastry, but leave me alone.
Thick and Thin looked at each other, then glanced around, not sure what to do next, not sure what plan B entailed.
Marco wasn't moving. Not that he felt very safe where he was, but he could almost see a dark car waiting around the corner.
Where the hell is Luigi right now? He asked himself. Is this part of his conspiracy?
He'd been discovered, found, unmasked, called by his real name on Via Fondazza. This would certainly mean another move, another safe house.
The thin one decided to take control of the encounter.
Sure, we can meet right here. There are a lot of folks back home who'd like to talk to you.
Maybe that's why I'm over here.
We're investigating the pardon you bought.
Then you're wasting a hell of a lot of time and money, which would surprise no one.
We have some questions about the transaction.
What a stupid investigation, Marco said, spitting the words down at the thin one. For the first time in many years, he felt like the broker again, berating some haughty bureaucrat or dim-witted congressman. The FBI spends good money sending two clowns like you all the way to Bologna, Italy, to tackle me on a sidewalk so you can ask me questions that no fool in his right mind would answer? You're a couple of dumbasses, you know that? Go back home and tell your boss that he's a dumbass, too. And while you're talking to him, tell him he's wasting a lot of time and money if he thinks I paid for a pardon.
So you deny? I deny nothing. I admit nothing. I say nothing, except that this is the FBI at its absolute worst.
You boys are in deep water, and you can't swim.
Back home, they'd slap him around a little. Push him, curse him, swap insults. But on foreign soil, they weren't sure how to behave. Their orders were to find him, to see if he did in fact live where the CIA said he was living, and if found, they were supposed to jolt him, scare him, hit him with some questions about wire transfers and offshore accounts. They had it all mapped out and had rehearsed it many times, but under the porticos of Via Fondazza, Mr. Lazzari was annihilating their plans.
We're not leaving Bologna until we talk, said the thick one.
Congratulations, you're in for a long vacation.
We have our orders, Mr. Backman.
And I've got mine.
Just a few questions, please, said the thin one.
Go see my lawyer, Marco said and began to walk away in the direction of his apartment.
Who's your lawyer?
Carl Pratt.
They weren't moving, weren't following, and Marco picked up his pace. He crossed the street, glanced quickly at his safe house, but didn't slow down. If they wanted to follow, they waited too long. By the time he darted onto Via del Piombo, he knew they could never find him. These were his streets now, his alleys, his darkened doorways to shops that wouldn't open for 3 more hours. They found him on Via Fondazza, only because they knew his address.
At the southwestern edge of Old Bologna, near the Porto San Stefano, he caught a city bus and rode it for half an hour, until he stopped near the train station at the northern perimeter. There he caught another bus and rode into the center of the city. The buses were filling. The early risers were getting to work. A third bus took him across the city again to the Porta Saragozza, where he began the 3.6-kilometer hike up to San Luca. At the 400th arch, he stopped to catch his breath, and between the columns, he looked down and waited for someone to come sneaking up behind him. There was no one back there as he expected. He slowed his pace and finished the climb in 55 minutes. Behind the Santuario di San Luca, he followed the narrow pathway where Francesca had fallen and finally parked himself on the bench where she had waited. From there, his early morning view of Bologna was magnificent. He removed his parka to cool off. The sun was up. The air was as light and clear as any he had ever breathed, and for a long time Marco sat very much alone and watched the city come to life. He treasured the solitude and the safety of the moment. Why couldn't he make the climb every morning and sit high above Bologna with nothing to do but think and maybe read the newspapers, perhaps call a friend on the phone and catch up on the gossip? He'd have to find the friends first. It was a dream that would not come true. With Luigi's very limited cell phone, he called Ermanno and canceled their morning session. Then he called Luigi and explained that he didn't feel like studying. "Is something wrong?" "No, I just need a break." "That's fine, Marco, but we're paying Ermanno to teach you, okay? You need to study every day." "Drop it, Luigi. I'm not studying today." "I don't like this. And I don't care. Suspend me. Kick me out of school." "Are you upset?" "No, Luigi, I'm fine. It's a beautiful day, springtime in Bologna, and I'm going for a long walk."
"Where?"
"No thanks, Luigi. I don't want company."
"What about lunch?"
Hunger pains shot through Marco's stomach. Lunch with Luigi was always delicious, and he always grabbed the check.
"Sure. Let me think. I'll call you back."
"Sure, Luigi. Ciao." They met at 12:30 at Café Atene, an ancient dive in an alley down a few steps from street level. It was a tiny place with small square tables practically touching each other. The waiters jostled around with trays of food held high overhead. Chefs yelled from the kitchen. The cramped dining room was smoky, loud, and packed with hungry people who enjoyed talking at full volume as they ate. Luigi explained that the restaurant had been around for centuries, tables were impossible to get, and the food was, of course, superb. He suggested they share a plate of calamari to get things started. After a morning of arguing with himself up at San Luca, Marco had decided not to tell Luigi about his encounter with the FBI. At least not then, not that morning. He might do it the next day or the next, but for the moment he was still sorting things out. His principal reason for holding back was that he did not want to pack up and run again, not on Luigi's terms. If he ran, he would be alone. He couldn't begin to imagine why the FBI would be in Bologna, evidently without the knowledge of Luigi and whoever he was working for. He was assuming Luigi knew nothing of their presence. He certainly seemed to be much more concerned with the menu and the wine list. Life was good. Everything was normal. The lights went out. Suddenly, Café Atene was completely dark, and in the next instant, a waiter with a tray of someone's lunch came crashing across their table, yelling and cursing and spilling himself onto both Luigi and Marco. The legs of the antique table buckled, and its edge crashed hard onto Marco's lap. At about the same time, a foot or something hit him hard on the left shoulder. Everyone was yelling, glass was breaking, bodies were getting shoved. Then from the kitchen, someone screamed, "Fire!" The scramble outside and onto the street was completed without serious injury. The last person out was Marco, who ducked low to avoid the stampede while searching for his navy blue Silvio bag. As always, he had hung its strap over the back of his chair, with the bag resting so close to his body he could usually feel it. It had disappeared in the melee. The Italians stood in the street and stared in disbelief at the cafe. Their lunch was in there, half eaten and now being ruined. Finally, a thin, light puff of smoke emerged and made its way through the door and into the air. A waiter could be seen running by the front tables with a fire extinguisher. Then some more smoke, but not much. "I lost my bag," Marco said to Luigi as they watched and waited.
"The blue one."
"How many bags do I carry around, Luigi?"
"Yes, the blue one."
He already had suspicions that the bag had been snatched. A small fire truck with an enormous siren arrived, slid to a stop, and kept wailing as the firemen raced inside. Minutes passed, and the Italians began to drift away. The decisive ones left to find lunch elsewhere while there was still time. The others just kept gawking at this horrible injustice. The siren was finally neutralized. Evidently, the fire was too, and without the need for water being sprayed all over the restaurant. After an hour of discussion and debate, and very little firefighting, the situation was under control.
"Something in the restroom,"
a waiter yelled to one of his friends, one of the few remaining weakened and unfed patrons. The lights were back on. They allowed them back inside to get their coats. Some who'd left in search of other meals were returning to get their things. Luigi became very helpful in the hunt for Marco's bag. He discussed the situation with the head waiter, and before long half the staff was scouring the restaurant. Among the excited chatter, Marco heard a waiter say something about a smoke bomb. The bag was gone, and Marco knew it. They had a panino and a beer at a sidewalk cafe under the sun where they could watch pretty girls stroll by. Marco was preoccupied with the theft, but he worked hard to appear unconcerned.
"Sorry about the bag," Luigi said at one point.
"No big deal.
I'll get you another cell phone."
"Thanks.
What else did you lose?"
"Nothing, just some maps of the city, some aspirin, a few euros." In a hotel room a few blocks away, Zellman and Crater had the bag on the bed, its contents neatly arranged. Other than the Ankyo smartphone, there were two maps of Bologna, both well-marked and well-used, but revealing little. Four $100 bills, the cell phone Luigi had loaned him, a bottle of aspirin, and the owner's manual for the Ankyo. Zellman, the more agile computer whiz of the two, plugged the smartphone into an internet access jack and was soon fiddling with the menu. "This is good stuff," he was saying, quite impressed with Marco's gadget. "The absolute latest toy on the market." Not surprisingly, he was stopped by the password. They would have to dissect it at Langley. With his laptop, he emailed a message to Julia Javier, passing along the serial number and other information. Within 2 hours of the theft, a CIA agent was sitting in the parking lot outside Chatter in suburban Alexandria, waiting for the store to open. Chapter 26. From a distance, he watched her shuffle along gamely, bravely with her cane, down the sidewalk beside Via Manzoni. He followed and was soon 50 feet away. Today she wore brown suede boots, no doubt for the support. The boots had low heels. Flat shoes would have been more comfortable, but then she was Italian and fashion always took priority. The light brown skirt stopped at her knees. She was wearing a tight wool sweater, bright red in color, and it was the first time he'd seen her when she wasn't bundled up for cold weather. No overcoat to hide her really nice figure. She was walking cautiously and limping slightly, but with a determination that gave him heart. It was just coffee at Nino's for an hour or two of Italian, and it was all for him. And the money. For a moment he thought about her money. Whatever the dire situation with her poor husband and her seasonal work as a tour guide, she managed to dress stylishly and live in a beautifully decorated apartment. Giovanni had been a professor. Perhaps he had saved carefully over the years, and now his illness was straining their budget. Whatever. Marco had his own problems. He'd just lost $400 in cash and his only lifeline to the outside world. People who weren't supposed to know his whereabouts now knew his exact address. 9 hours earlier, he'd heard his real name used on Via Fandazza. He slowed and allowed her to enter Nino's, where she was again greeted like a beloved member of the family by Nino's boys. Then he circled the block to give them time to get her situated, to fuss over her, bring her coffee, chat for a moment, and catch up on the neighborhood gossip. 10 minutes after she arrived, he walked through the door and got bear-hugged by Nino's youngest son. A friend of Francesca's was a friend for life. Her moods changed so much that Marco did not know what to expect.
He was still touched by the warmth of yesterday, but he knew that the indifference could return today. When she smiled and grabbed his hand and started all the cheek pecking, he knew instantly the lesson would be the highlight of a rotten day. When they were finally alone, he asked about her husband. Things had not changed. "It's only a matter of days," she said with a stiff lip, as if she had already accepted death and was ready for the grieving. He asked about her mother, Signora Altanelli, and got a full report. She was baking a pear torta, one of Giovanni's favorites, just in case he got a whiff of it from the kitchen. "And how was your day?" she asked. It would be impossible to fictionalize a worse set of occurrences. From the shock of hearing his real name barked through the darkness to being the victim of a carefully staged theft, he couldn't imagine a worse day. "A little excitement during lunch," he said.
"Tell me about it."
He described his hike up to San Luca, to the spot where she fell, her bench, the views, the canceled session with Ermano, lunch with Luigi, the fire and the loss of his bag. She had not noticed the absence of it until he told the story.
"There's so little crime in Bologna," she said, half apologetic. "I know Café Atene. It's not a place for thieves."
These were probably not Italians, he wanted to say, but managed to nod gravely as if to say, "Yes, yes, what's the world coming to?" When the small talk was over, she switched gears like a stern professor and said she was in the mood to tackle some verbs. He said he was not, but his moods were unimportant. She drilled him on the future tense of abitare, to live, and vedere, to see. Then she made him weave both verbs in all tenses into 100 random sentences. Far from being distracted, she pounced on any wayward accent. A grammatical mistake prompted a quick reprimand, as if he had just insulted the entire country. She had spent the day penned up in her apartment with a dying husband and a busy mother. The lesson was her only chance to release some energy. Marco, however, was exhausted. The stress of the day was taking its toll, but Francesca's high-octane demands took his mind off his fatigue and confusion. 1 hour passed quickly. They recharged with more coffee, and she launched into the murky and difficult world of the subjunctive, present, imperfect, and past perfect. Finally, he began to founder. She tried to prop him up with reassurances that the subjunctive sinks a lot of students, but he was tired and ready to sink. He surrendered after 2 hours, thoroughly drained and in need of another long walk. It took 15 minutes to say goodbye to Nino's boys. He happily escorted her back to her apartment. They hugged and pecked cheeks and promised to study tomorrow. If he walked as directly as possible, his apartment was 25 minutes away, but he had not walked directly to any place in more than a month. He began to wander. At 4 p.m., 8 of the Kidan were on Via Fondazza at various points, one drinking coffee at a sidewalk cafe, 3 strolling aimlessly a block apart, 1 cruising back and forth on a scooter, and 1 looking out a window from the 3rd floor. Half a mile away outside the central city on the 2nd floor, above a flower shop owned by an elderly Jew, the 4 other members of the Kidan were playing cards and waiting nervously. One, Ari, was one of the top English interrogators within the Mossad. They played with little conversation. The night ahead would be long and unpleasant. Throughout the day, Marco had struggled with the question of whether to return to Via Fondazza. The FBI boys could still be there, ready for another ugly confrontation. He felt sure they would not be stiff-armed so easily. They wouldn't simply call it quits and catch a plane. They had superiors back home who demanded results. Though far from certain, he had a strong hunch that Luigi was behind the theft of his Silvio bag. The fire had not really been a fire. It was more of a diversion, a reason for the lights to go off, and a cover for someone to grab the bag. He didn't trust Luigi, because he trusted no one. They had his cute little smartphone. Neil's codes were in there somewhere.
Could they be broken? Could the trail lead to his son? Marco had not the slightest idea how those things worked, what was possible, what was impossible. The urge to leave Bologna was overwhelming. Where to go and how to get there were questions he had not sorted out. He was rambling now, and he felt vulnerable, almost helpless. Every face glancing at him was someone else who knew his real name. At a crowded bus stop, he cut the line and climbed on, not sure where he was going. The bus was packed with weary commuters, shoulder to shoulder as they bounced along. Through the windows, he watched the foot traffic under the marvelous crowded porticos of the city center. At the last second, he jumped off, then walked 3 blocks along Via San Vitale until he saw another bus. He rode in circles for almost an hour, then finally stepped off near the train station. He drifted with another crowd, then darted across Via dell'Indipendenza to the bus station. Inside, he found the departures, saw that one was leaving in 10 minutes for Piacenza, an hour and a half away with 5 stops in between. He bought a ticket for €30 and hid in the restroom until the last minute. The bus was almost full. The seats were wide with high headrests, and as the bus moved slowly through heavy traffic, Marco almost nodded off. Then he caught himself. Sleeping was not permissible. This was it, the escape he had been contemplating since the first day in Bologna. He'd become convinced that to survive, he would be forced to disappear, to leave Luigi behind and make it on his own. He had often wondered exactly how and when the flight would begin. What would trigger it? A face? A threat? Would he take a bus or train? Cab or plane? Where would he go? Where would he hide? Would his rudimentary Italian get him through it? How much money would he have at the time? This was it. It was happening. There was no turning back now. The first stop was the small village of Bazzano, 15 kilometers west of Bologna. Marco got off the bus and did not get back on. Again, he hid in the restroom of the station until the bus was gone, then crossed the street to a bar where he ordered a beer and asked the bartender about the nearest hotel. Over his second beer, he asked about the train station and learned that Bazzano did not have one. Only buses, said the bartender. Albergo Cantino was near the center of the village, 5 or 6 blocks away. It was dark when he arrived at the front desk with no bags, something that did not go unnoticed by the signora who handled things. I'd like a room, he said in Italian.
For how many nights?
Only one.
The rate is 55 euros.
Fine.
Your passport, please.
Sorry, but I lost it. Her plucked and painted eyebrows arched in great suspicion. Then she began shaking her head. Sorry. Marco laid 200 euro bills on the counter in front of her. The bribe was obvious. Just take the cash, no paperwork, and give me a key. More shaking, more frowning.
You must have a passport, she said.
Then she folded her arms across her chest, jerked her chin upward, braced for the next exchange. There was no way she was going to lose. Outside, Marco walked the streets of the strange town. He found a bar and ordered coffee. No more alcohol. He had to keep his wits. Where can I find a taxi? He asked the bartender.
At the bus station.
By 9 p.m., Luigi was walking the floors of his apartment, waiting for Marco to return next door. He called Francesca, and she reported that they had studied that afternoon. In fact, they'd had a delightful lesson. Great, he thought. His disappearance was part of the plan, but Whitaker and Langley thought it would take a few more days. Had they lost him already? That quickly? There were now 5 agents very close by, Luigi, Zellman, Crater, and 2 others sent from Milano. Luigi had always questioned the plan. In a city the size of Bologna, it was impossible to maintain physical surveillance of a person 24 hours a day. Luigi had argued almost violently that the only way for the plan to work was to stash Bachmann away in a small village where his movements were limited, his options few, and his visitors much more visible.
That had been the original plan, but the details had been abruptly changed in Washington. At 9:12, a buzzer quietly went off in the kitchen. He hurried to the monitors in the kitchen. Marco was home. His front door was opening. Luigi stared at the digital image from the hidden camera in the ceiling of the living room next door. Two strangers, not Marco, two men in their 30s dressed like regular guys. They closed the door quickly, quietly, professionally, then began looking around. One carried a small black bag of some sort. They were good, very good. To pick the lock of the safe house, they had to be very good. Luigi smiled with excitement. With a little luck, his cameras were about to record Marco getting nabbed. Maybe they would kill him right there in the living room, captured on film. Perhaps the plan would work after all. He flipped the audio switches and increased the volume. Language was crucial here. Where were they from? What was their tongue? There were no sounds, though, as they moved about silently. They whispered once or twice, but he could barely hear it. Chapter 27. The taxi made an abrupt stop on Via Gramsci near the bus and train stations. From the back seat, Marco handed over enough cash, then ducked between two parked cars and was soon lost in the darkness. His escape from Bologna had been very brief indeed, but then it wasn't exactly over. He zigzagged out of habit, looping back, watching his own trail. On Via Menzoni, he moved quickly under the porticos and stopped at her apartment building. He didn't have the luxury of second thoughts, of hesitating or guessing. He rang twice, desperately hoping that Francesca, and not Signora Altinelli, would answer.
"Who is it?"
came that lovely voice.
"Francesca, it's me, Marco. I need some help."
A very slight pause, then,
"Yes, of course."
She met him at her door on the second floor and invited him in. Much to his dismay, Signora Altinelli was still there, standing in the kitchen door with a hand towel, watching his entrance very closely.
"Are you all right?"
Francesca asked in Italian.
"English, please,"
he said, looking and smiling at her mother.
"Yes, of course. I need a place to stay tonight. I can't get a room because I have no passport. I can't even bribe my way into a small hotel. That's the law in Europe, you know."
"Yes, I'm learning." She waved at the sofa, then turned to her mother and asked her to make some coffee. They sat down. He noticed she was barefoot and moving about without the cane, though she still needed it. She wore tight jeans and a baggy sweater and looked as cute as a co-ed.
"Why don't you tell me what's going on?" she said.
"It's a complicated story, and I can't tell you most of it. Let's just say that I don't feel very safe right now, that I really need to leave Bologna as soon as possible."
"Where are you going?"
"I'm not sure. Somewhere out of Italy, out of Europe, to a place where I'll hide again."
"How long will you hide?"
"A long time. I'm not sure." She stared at him coldly without blinking. He stared back, because even when cold, the eyes were beautiful.
"Who are you?" she asked.
"Well, I'm certainly not Marco Lazzari."
"What are you running from?"
"My past, and it's rapidly catching up with me. I'm not a criminal, Francesca. I was once a lawyer. I got in some trouble. I served my time. I've been fully pardoned. I'm not a bad guy."
"Why is someone after you?"
"It was a business deal 6 years ago. Some very nasty people are not happy with how the deal was finished. They blame me. They would like to find me."
"To kill you?"
"Yes, that's what they'd like to do."
"This is very confusing. Why did you come here? Why did Luigi help you? Why did he hire me and Ermanno? I don't understand."
"And I can't answer those questions. 2 months ago, I was in prison, and I thought I would be there for another 14 years. Suddenly, I'm free. I was given a new identity, brought here, hidden first in Treviso, now Bologna. I think they want to kill me here."
"Here? In Bologna?"
He nodded and looked toward the kitchen as Signora Altanelli appeared with a tray of coffee and also a pear torta that had not yet been sliced. As she placed it delicately on a small plate for Marco, he realized that he had not eaten since lunch. Lunch with Luigi. Lunch with the fake fire and the stolen smartphone. He thought of Neil again and worried about his safety. "It's delicious," he said to her mother in Italian. Francesca was not eating. She watched every move he made, every bite, every sip of coffee. When her mother went back to the kitchen, she said, "Who does Luigi work for?" "I'm not sure. Probably the CIA. You know the CIA?" "Yes, I read spy novels." "The CIA put you here?" "I think the CIA got me out of prison, out of the country, and here to Bologna, where they've hidden me in a safe house while they try and figure out what to do with me."
"Will they kill you?"
"Maybe."
"Luigi?"
"Possibly." She placed her cup on the table and fiddled with her hair for a while.
"Would you like some water?" she asked as she got to her feet.
"No, thanks.
I need to move a little,"
she said as she carefully placed weight on her left foot. She walked slowly into the kitchen where things were quiet for a moment before an argument broke out. She and her mother were disagreeing rather heatedly, but they were forced to do so in loud, tense whispers. It dragged on for a few minutes, died down, then flared up as neither side seemed ready to yield. Finally, Francesca came limping back with a small bottle of San Pellegrino and took her place on the sofa. "What was that all about?" he asked.
"I told her you wanted to sleep here tonight. She misunderstood."
"Come on, I'll sleep in the closet. I don't care."
"She's very old-fashioned."
"Is she staying here tonight?"
"She is now."
"Just give me a pillow. I'll sleep on the kitchen table." Signora Altanelli was a different person when she returned to remove the coffee tray. She glared at Marco as if he had already molested her daughter. She glared at Francesca as if she wanted to slap her. She huffed around the kitchen for a few minutes, then retired somewhere back in the apartment.
"Are you sleepy?" Francesca asked.
"No.
You?" "No. Let's talk."
"Okay.
Tell me everything."
He slept a few hours on the sofa and was awakened by Francesca tapping on his shoulder.
"I have an idea," she said. "Follow me."
He followed her to the kitchen, where a clock read 4:15. On the counter by the sink was a disposable razor, a can of shaving cream, a pair of eyeglasses, and a bottle of hair something or other. He couldn't translate it. She handed him a small burgundy leather case and said,
"This is a passport. Giovanni's."
He almost dropped it.
"No, I can't."
"Yes, you can.
He won't be needing it. I insist."
Marco slowly opened it and looked at the distinguished face of a man he'd never meet. The expiration date was 7 months away, so the photo was almost 5 years old. He found the birthday. Giovanni was now 68 years old, a good 20 years older than his wife. During the cab ride back from Bazzano, he had thought of nothing but a passport. He had thought about stealing one from an unsuspecting tourist. He had thought about buying one somewhere on the black market, but had no idea where to go. And he had pondered Giovanni's, one that sadly was about to be useless. Null and void. But he'd dismissed the thought for fear of endangering Francesca. What if he got caught? What if an immigration guard at an airport got suspicious and called his supervisor over? But his biggest fear was getting caught by the people who were chasing him. The passport could implicate her, and he would never do that.
"Are you sure?" he asked.
Now that he was holding the passport, he really wanted to keep it.
"Please, Marco, I want to help."
Giovanni would insist.
"I don't know what to say." "We have work to do. There's a bus for Parma that leaves in 2 hours. It would be a safe way out of town."
"I want to get to Milano," he said.
"Good idea."
She took the passport and opened it. They studied the photo of her husband.
"Let's start with that thing around your mouth," she said.
10 minutes later, the mustache and goatee were gone, his face completely shaven. She held a mirror for him as he hovered over the kitchen sink. Giovanni, at 63, had less gray hair than Marco at 52,
But then he had not had the experience of a federal indictment and 6 years in prison. He assumed the hair coloring was something she used, but he was not about to ask. It promised results in an hour. He sat in a chair facing the table with a towel draped over his shoulders while she gently worked the solution through his hair. Very little was said. Her mother was asleep. Her husband was still and quiet and heavily medicated. Not long ago, Giovanni, the professor, had worn round tortoiseshell eyeglasses, light brown, quite the academic look, and when Marco put them on and studied his new look, he was startled at the change. His hair was much darker, his eyes much different. He hardly recognized himself.
"Not bad," was her assessment of her own work. "It will do for now."
She brought in a navy corduroy sports coat with well-worn patches on the elbows.
"He's about 2 inches shorter than you," she said.
The sleeves needed another inch, and the jacket would have been tight through the chest. But Marco was so thin these days that anything would swallow him.
"What's your real name?"
she said as she tugged on the sleeves and adjusted the collar.
"Joel. I think you should travel with a briefcase. It will look normal."
He couldn't argue. Her generosity was overwhelming, and he needed every damned bit of it. She left, then came back with a beautiful old briefcase, tan leather with a silver buckle.
"I don't know what to say," Marco mumbled. "It's Giovanni's favorite, a gift from me 20 years ago. Italian leather."
"Of course."
"If you get caught somehow with the passport, what will you say?" she asked.
"I stole it. You're my tutor. I was in your home as a guest. I managed to find the drawer with your documents, and I stole your husband's passport."
"You're a good liar."
"At one time, I was one of the best. If I get caught, Francesca, I will protect you. I promise. I will tell lies that will baffle everyone."
"You won't get caught. But use the passport as little as possible."
"Don't worry. I'll destroy it as soon as I can."
"Do you need money?"
"No."
"Are you sure? I have 1,000 euros here."
"No, Francesca, but thanks.
You'd better hurry."
He followed her to the front door where they stopped and looked at each other. "Do you spend much time online?" he asked.
"A little each day."
"Check out Joel Backman. Start with the Washington Post. There's a lot of stuff there, but don't believe everything you read. I'm not the monster they've created."
"You're not a monster at all, Joel.
I don't know how to thank you." She took his right hand and squeezed it with both of hers.
"Will you ever return to Bologna?" she asked.
It was more of an invitation than a question. "I don't know. I really don't have any idea what's about to happen. But maybe. Can I knock on your door if I make it back?"
"Please do. Be careful out there."
He stood in the shadows of Via Menzoni for a few minutes, not wanting to leave her, not ready to begin the long journey. Then there was a cough from under the darkened porticos across the street, and Giovanni Ferro was on the run. Chapter 28. As the hours passed with excruciating slowness, Luigi gradually moved from worry to panic. One of two things had happened. Either the hit had already occurred, or Marco had gotten wind of something and was trying to flee. Luigi worried about the stolen bag. Was it too strong a move? Had it scared Marco to the point of disappearing? The expensive smartphone had shaken everyone. Their boy had been doing much more than studying Italian, walking the streets, and sampling every cafe and bar in town. He had been planning and communicating. The smartphone was in a lab in the basement of the American Embassy in Milan, where, according to the latest from Whitaker, and they were talking every 15 minutes, the technicians had been unable to crack its codes. A few minutes after midnight, the two intruders next door evidently got tired of waiting. As they were making their exit, they spoke a few words loud enough to be recorded. It was English with a trace of an accent. Luigi had immediately called Whitaker and reported that they were probably Israeli. He was correct. The two agents were instructed by Ephraim to leave the apartment and take up other positions. When they left, Luigi decided to send Crater to the bus station and Zelman to the train station,
With no passport, Marco could not buy a plane ticket. Luigi decided to ignore the airport. But, as he told Whitaker, if their boy can somehow buy a state-of-the-art cell phone PC that cost about $1,000, maybe he could also find himself a passport. By 3 a.m., Whitaker was yelling in Milano, and Luigi, who couldn't yell for security reasons, could only curse, which he was doing in English and Italian, and holding his own in both languages. "You've lost him, damn it," Whitaker screeched. "Not yet. He's already dead." Luigi hung up again for the third time that morning. The Kidon pulled back around 3:30 a.m. They would all rest for a few hours, then plan the day ahead. He sat with a wino on a bench in a small park, not far down Via dell'Indipendenza from the bus station. The wino had been nursing a jug of pink fluid for most of the night, and every 5 minutes or so, he managed to lift his head and utter something at Marco 5 feet away. Marco mumbled back, and whatever he said seemed to please the wino. Two of his colleagues were completely comatose and were huddled nearby like dead soldiers in a trench. Marco didn't feel exactly safe, but then he had more serious problems. A few people loitered in front of the bus station. Around 5:30, activity increased when a large group of what appeared to be gypsies came bustling out, all speaking loudly at once, obviously delighted to be off the bus after a long ride from somewhere. More departing passengers were arriving, and Marco decided it was time to leave the wino. He entered the station behind a young couple and their child and followed them to the ticket counter where he listened as they bought tickets to Parma. He did the same, then hurried to the restroom and again hid in a stall. Crater was sitting in the station's all-night diner, drinking bad coffee behind a newspaper while he watched the passengers come and go. He watched Marco walk by. He noted his height, build, age. The walk was familiar, though much slower. The Marco Lazzari he had been following for weeks could walk as fast as most men could jog. This fellow's pace was much slower, but then there was nowhere to go. Why hurry? On the streets, Lazzari was always trying to lose them, and at times he was successful. But the face was very different. The hair was much darker. The brown corduroy cap was gone, but then it was an accessory and easy to lose. The tortoiseshell eyeglasses caught Crater's attention. Glasses were wonderful diversions, but so often they were overplayed. Marco's stylish Armani frames had fit him perfectly, slightly altering his appearance without calling attention to his face. The round glasses on this guy begged for attention. The facial hair was gone, a 5-minute job something anyone would do. The shirt was not one Crater had seen before, and he'd been in Marco's apartment with Luigi during sweeps when they looked at every item of clothing. The faded jeans were very generic, and Marco had purchased a similar pair. The blue sports coat with worn elbow patches, along with the handsome attaché, kept Crater in his chair. The jacket had many miles on it, something Marco could not have acquired. The sleeves were a bit short, but that was not uncommon. The briefcase was made of fine leather. Marco might somehow find and spend some cash on a smartphone, but why waste it on such an expensive briefcase? His last bag, the navy blue Silvio he had owned until about 16 hours ago when Crater grabbed it during the melee at Café Atene, had cost 60 euros. Crater watched him until he rounded a corner and was out of sight. A possibility, nothing more. He sipped his coffee and for a few minutes contemplated the gentleman he had just seen. Marco stood in the stall with his jeans bunched around his ankles, feeling quite silly but much more concerned with a good cover at this point. The door opened. The wall to the left of the door had 4 urinals. Across were 6 lavatories, and next to them were 4 stalls. The other 3 were empty. There was very little traffic at that moment. Marco listened carefully, waiting to hear the sounds of human relief, the zipper, the jangle of a belt buckle, the deep sigh men often make, the spray of urine. Nothing. There was no noise from the lavatories, no one washing their hands. The doors to the other three stalls did not open. Maybe it was the custodian making his rounds and doing so very quietly. In front of the lavatories, Crater bent low, saw the jeans around the ankles in the last stall. Next to the jeans was the fine briefcase. The gentleman was taking care of his business and in no hurry about it. The next bus left at 6 a.m. for Parma. After that, there was a 6:20 departure for Florence. Crater hurried to the booth and bought tickets for both. The clerk looked at him oddly, but Crater couldn't have cared less. He went back to the restroom. The gentleman in the last stall was still there. Crater stepped outside and called Luigi. He gave a description of the man and explained that he appeared to be in no hurry to leave the men's room.
"The best place to hide," Luigi said. "I've done it many times."
"Do you think it's Marco?"
"I don't know. If it is, it's a very good disguise."
Rattled by the smartphone, the $400 in American cash, and the disappearance, Luigi was not taking chances.
"Follow him," he said.
At 5:55, Marco pulled up his jeans, flushed, grabbed his briefcase, and took off for the bus. Waiting on the platform was Crater, nonchalantly eating an apple with one hand and holding a newspaper with the other. When Marco headed for the bus to Parma, so did Crater. A third of the seats were empty. Marco took one on the left side, halfway back by a window. Crater was looking away when he passed by, then found a seat four rows behind him.